no recruit. Second emblem of organized social feminism occurred in a context of what popular culture has of course labeled the sexual revolution, which we've come to think of as the heterosexual revolution, or, to use Mary Ryan's felicitous phrase, the heterosexual imperative. The heterosexual imperative had two separate but interrelated foci. One was the rise of companionate marriage between men and women, and the other was the outcasting of female-centered sociability as lesbian and hence immature. From the 1890s on, heterosexuality was discovered as an area for study and meditation. While earlier generations of women had internalized notions of sexual difference and distance between women and men, the writings of the new sexual modernists, like Havelock Ellis, G. Stanley Hall, Freud, and his battery of female followers, including Marie Bonaparte and Helen Deutsch, and really had a fix in a minute, constructed a new normative image of the female. Orgasm was proclaimed to be a natural imperative, a release to be sought by women as well as by men. Yet, early sexual surveys revealed an epidemic of female frigidity within marriage. The repressive nature of Victorian marriage was then critiqued in favor of a vision of marriage in which partners might view one another as friends as well as lovers. The image of maternity as women's ultimate function was replaced by that of her sexual partnership. During the 20s, new categories were suggested by sexology within which women were taught to think of themselves. Lack of orgasm with male partners indicated resistance to fully adult heterosexuality. Frigid women were labeled immature or even masculine. Indeed, psychologists routinely labeled feminists as neurotic, sublimating sadists and saw their homosocial liaisons as compensations for their lack of heteroerotic success. The 19th Amendment might bring women and men together in the political sphere, but it remained for the new army of psychologists and sexologists to bring them together in the domestic sphere. The new focus on heterosexuality took place in a context both material and ideological. The spread of vulcanized rubber with condoms and diaphragms made birth control more trustworthy. By the late 20s, about 80% of upper middle class families reported using birth control, and by the 30s, a third of working class women interviewed reported using it as well. At the same time, social scientists and journalists examined the institution of marriage, advocating divorce, serial marriage, and even trial marriage for problems of sexual incompatibility. Adolescence took on a new cultural meaning and was increasingly seen as a period of preparation for full heterosexuality. That's a point we'll get back to. In such contexts, the rate of non-marital heterosexual activity doubled during the 1920s. As many feminists have pointed out, this sexual revolution was a double-edged sword. While women undoubtedly benefited from the open discussion of the problematic nature of heterosexuality, they also lost the diffuse homosocial and homosexual milieu within which earlier generations of women had operated. Lesbianism became the subject of intense speculation and pathologization. Survey after survey revealed that college-educated women had had rich experiences with homoeroticism. Catherine Davis's very famous questionnaires were published in 1929, and they said that 25% of college women had lesbian experiences. Those women who kept their social distance from men, who continued to live in what was popularly known as the Boston marriage, in which women depended on one another for emotional fulfillment, were seen as an obstacle to the growth of companionate marriage, companionate, that is, between men. By turns cajoled and encouraged to give up their immaturity, by turns castigated for their rejection of male-centered coitus, lesbians became a negative social and scientific category. Christina Simmons points out in her article about the growth of lesbianism in consciousness and sexology, in cultural terms, lesbianism represented women's autonomy in various forms, feminism, careers, refusal to marry, failure to adjust to marital sexuality. It became a symbol in a cultural context of increased expectation and evaluation of sexual activity for women as well as for men. As the heterosexual revolution progressed, prior homosocial institutions came to be viewed as old-fashioned and lost their social legitimacy. The proportion of single-sex colleges declined continuously as co-education became more popular. By the end of the 20s, greater numbers of women were being educated, but the context and content of their education had been transformed. Home economics, for example, became the most popular major in colleges. The rise of sororities eclipsed earlier civic and reform clubs on campuses, focusing social attention on popularity, on sex appeal, and on becoming an ideal wife companion. At the same time, settlement houses declined in social and financial importance as social work became a profession rather than a live-in vocation. Young women were no longer encouraged to devote a lifetime to social housekeeping. Restrictive immigration quotas passed in 1921 caused the pool of prospective clients to dry up. In their place, black southern migrants began to fill poor urban neighborhoods, and their social needs were not considered fundable in a period of racist resurgence. It's important to note that black women's clubs continue to be very active in settlement housing at this period. Above all, the focus on companionate marriage reorganized the most prevalent of all homosocial institutions, the family itself. Generations of women have been connected to one another through mutual ties of the life cycle, domesticity, and productive work within their families. This is the context which Nancy Cott, Nancy Solly, and Carol Smith Rosenberg so excellently described for the middle classes of the 19th century. It's also the basis of urban working class family life, as reported by Elsie Clunes Parsons, an anthropologist who studied New York tenements in 1905. There she found female-centered helping networks of kin and neighbors who organized survival and sociability under conditions of urban poverty, a report with which we have again become familiar in the presentation. But the public schools, settlement houses, dance halls, and street life also made claims on immigrant daughters that separated them from the world of their mothers. Through these institutions, working class girls soon learned that the focus of their attention and their paychecks should be on attractiveness to men. Bolstered by the influence of advertising and the movies, girls learned they might catch and keep an attractive husband by buying and using a myriad of American products of femininity. Peer culture began to replace multi-generational single-sex cultures. This was true for boys as well. It's a period of the rise of boys' clubs, of sports clubs, of the Boy Scouts, in order to replace skills that are no longer transmitted from father to son. So that's also part of the Americanization experience. 50% of the nation's youth was attending high schools in the 20s, and high school was the environment within which heterosexual youth culture really flourished. In Middletown, a city of 35,000, there were 14 girls' clubs to sponsor dances and high school events, and dozens of boys' clubs promoting athletics. Mass mobilization and hysteria surrounded the endless cycle of basketball, football, baseball, accompanied by cheerleading and boosterism. Such activities replaced prior family-centered forms of entertainment, like visiting, picnics, or Chautauqua lecture series, in favor of peer culture events. Also important to the reorganization of the social life of peer groups was an invention every contemporary parent recognized as family-shaking. If you want to know what's changing here in Middletown, one informant commented to the Winds, it's spelled A-U-T-O. Motoring by youths replaced porch-sitting and picnicking by families as autos bought on credit spread. By 1923, 4 million cars were manufactured in America, and there were two of them for every three families in Middletown. The autonomy implied in autos created great social upheaval. Use of the car was listed as one of the most serious causes of family disputes among Middletown's teenagers, and the majority of juvenile courts handled as girls' sex crimes in 1924 were listed as taking place in cars. In the same period, the growth of the movie industry produced a mass culture consumed across the continent. It was popular in all classes, but one study revealed that working class families spent twice annually what middle class professional families spent on going to the movies, even though they had much lower incomes. The popularity and impact of movies was enormous. In Middletown, for example, programs changed frequently. You could see 300 different screenings during a year, and teenagers in high school reported going 1 to 3 times a week each. While Wild West films were very popular, by far the most admired films were society romances, with titles like Married Flirts, The Daring Years, Flaming Youth, Old Wives for New, Why Change Your Wife. Such movies produced a revised social anatomy of romantic heterosexuality. Girls reported to survey researchers that they had learned details of making love from the movies, like what to do with both pairs of arms in an embrace.
That doesn't come naturally.
Really, you have got to learn it. As one 17-year-old put it, no wonder girls of the older days before movies were so modest and bashful. They had never seen Clara Bow and William Haynes. If we did not see such examples, where would we get the idea of being hot? We would not. As Liz Ewing points out, such films had a major impact on the Americanization of urban immigrant girls, whose assimilation linked bourgeois fantasy, consumption, and heterosexuality. all experiences that were to be had outside of their families. Among the native born of Middletown, Ruby advertised, "Girls, if you want to know what love really means, its exquisite torture, its overwhelming rapture, see," and then the name of this week's film. And as one working class mother told the Lynns, "I send my daughter because a girl has to learn the ways of the world somehow, and the movies are a good, safe way." Others disagreed. Judges in towns considered movies linked to juvenile delinquency, and some high school teachers blamed them for the too early sophistication among their students. Peer culture, shaped by the spread of consumerism in autos and in movie houses, was a powerful force in demobilizing the homosocial, intergenerational world within which social feminism had flourished. As one thoughtful ex-suffragist remarked in 1928, "The feministic movement just isn't all that smart among the juniors." Sold on celluloid, male-oriented images of glamour, young women were no longer recruitable to what appeared to them to be outmoded causes. And sold they really were. The 1920s witnessed the rise of government, corporate, and academic surveys of consumer tastes, the growth of mass advertising, and the evolution of widespread credit arrangements, including the ubiquitous installment plan. By the end of the decade, there were 25 million cars registered in America, and 75% of them had been bought on credit. A new system of credit, fixed monthly mortgage payments, helped spur the home building industry, which profited from the housing shortage. Homeowning, so essential to the profits of banks and of industry, was lauded in patriotic terms. No greater contribution could be made to the stability of the nation and the advancement of its ideals than to make it a nation of homeowners, proclaimed Calvin Coolidge. Inside these newly owned homes, the cult of installment plan consumption flourished. During the 20s, 70% of American homes had electricity. Appliances were advertised through, sometimes bought on credit from, and repaired gratis by the power companies, who sold them like that to load their use rates. 70% of gas stoves and 90% of the washing machines and sewing machines bought in a decade were purchased on credit. Packaged foods also boomed. By 1920, most Americans consumed packaged bread, and during that time, Campbell's, Kellogg's, and Quaker Oats became household words. Most Americans also switched to store-bought, ready-made clothing, purchased from mail-order houses and department stores. American businesses soon learned that 80% of domestic consumption funds were spent by women. Sexologists of an earlier generation had argued that the new family would be strengthened, not torn apart, by increased passion instead of restraint. The new market researchers similarly argued that it would be strengthened by learning to spend and not to save. Christina Frederick's popular 1929 book, Selling Mrs. Consumer, made a strong case for the fusion of domestic science and marketing research. And by the end of the decade, in home economics courses in high schools and colleges, it was buying, not frugality, that became defined as the civic duty of young women. When in the 1920s, the General Confederation of Women's Clubs offered their membership list for use in both consumer and sexual surveys, the fusion of the two topics was anything but accidental. Ladies' Home Journal labeled the decade of the 20s not the sexual revolution, but the cosmetics revolution, as the popularity of products that was producing both heterosexual imagery and home markets for industry increased. Mass circulation pulp journals full of Avon's, Pond's, and Woodbury cream ads created needs for products which constructed the women who used them. By the late 20s, True Romance had a circulation of 2 million, and like Ladies' Home Journal and Good Housekeeping, it mingled sex and sales. What Mary Ryan has described as the sexy sales lady became a standard cultural image in this period. Full of energy and beauty, she put her feminine youth to the service of consumption. By the end of the decade, beauty pageants had taken on a standardized, popular format. Women had been trained not only to do the consuming, but to be consumed as well.
With the formal legal equality of the 19th Amendment and the barrage of writing that sought to transform the woman question into a psychological issue, much that passed for feminist thought dealt with individual choices and personal fulfillment. Lifestyle feminism replaced its activist predecessor. Ruth Pickering, one of those modern women whose stories was printed in The Nation in the 1920s, it's been reprinted in a feminist press edition that's very terrific, wrote, "I have traded my sense of exhilarating defiance," parentheses, she says, shall we call it feminism, "for an assurance of free and unimpeded self-expression," or shall we call that feminism, she asks. In other words, she goes on, I have grown up. Confessions from feminist new style, as they were sometimes called, who had given up employment for domestic life, wrote about their choice in articles like, I gave up my law books for a cookbook, or you may have my job, a feminist discovers her home. Articles which focused on their own choices and their rewards, but never analyzed the enormous material difficulties involved in women's double shifts at home or at work, or the obstacles even professional women faced on the job. Female self-assertiveness, where it existed at all, took unpolitical forms. We're not out to benefit society, one young woman told an interviewer in 1928. We're out for Mary's job and Luella's art and Barbara's independence and the rest of our individual careers and desires. Themes of female independence, even militancy, remained throughout the 20s, but they were thoroughly co-opted, resurfacing in advertising. The most impressive example of which was staged in 1929 by advertising consultant Edward Bernays, Freud's nephew. In that year's Easter parade, and accompanied by enormous publicity, Bernays organized a contingent of smoking women in formations aping the suffrage demonstrations of an earlier decade. Why not a parade of women lighting torches of freedom, smoking cigarettes, he had suggested, the American Tobacco Company for whom he organized this thing. We had indeed come a long way. By way of conclusion, we'd like to give you our sense of some of the political lessons to be learned through the study of this first round of feminist demobilization in the 20s. While the 20s and the 80s are very different, that what seems similar is that they are both periods of backlash on many levels, political and personal, conscious and also unconscious. Like us, feminists in the 20s faced the rise to control in Washington of a government totally hostile to feminism and other progressive causes, representing capital in its baldest form and willing to label their opponents as subversive and un-American. As in our own period, in the 20s, the economy was being restructured, theirs toward massive growth, ours toward contraction, in part by reconstructing families and the minds and activities of women within them. We'd like to end our presentation with five issues that to us are raised by this study of the 20s, which we hope can be the focus for our discussion. And we'd like people to discuss these issues for the present using the materials that we've presented and stuff from your own political experience and this morning and so on. And especially because we're not experts on this period, we would not like to spend the time analyzing the 20s particularly. So this is the first of the issues that we want to lay out for you. Red baiting can have the effect, as it did in the 20s, of breaking up political coalitions and paring away wavering support. Lesbian baiting, part of the 20s backlash process as well, may be more central this time around. We are especially concerned about a growing government infrastructure, the Senate Committee on Internal Terrorism being one big piece of it, which is very likely to link the two, that is anti-feminism, anti-Americanism. Any red and lesbian baiting used against any opposition group, not necessarily ours, needs to be combated because it could easily be used next on our own. The second of these issues. While many women today are hoping to survive the coming dark age through strengthening their friendship and personal networks, we were particularly sober to conclude that personal networks and activist groups are closely intertwined. But it is not easy to think of maintaining the personal networks without the activist arm. The settlement houses of the 20s, the women's colleges, the women's union, there were women's locals in the textile industry in the early part of the 20s. These were simultaneous personal and political networks, and their undermining was sure to weaken feminism. A third issue that we found thinking about what happened to earlier feminists is that burnout, that is the loss of feminist energy, is not simply a psychological issue. Feminists in the 20s experienced the loss of momentum in at least three locales. One was that they got tied up in terrible legal defensive battles in hostile courts
at the cost of time, money, and political isolation for the women who had to go and fight them. We know that we must fight such struggles right now in the courts, but it seems very important to maintain a larger political perspective and a political community while we're in those struggles, lest we end up isolated. The 20s was a time in which feminists were unable to recruit later generations. They got to have the image of being stodgy to the young. For ourselves, it seems extremely important to defend the institutions that we have managed to date to build, to make sure that we have a base for recruiting younger women into the women's community. I know many people in this room have been through the pros and cons of women's studies programs, and we've all hit the limits and said, no, this is not enough, and the critique of what's wrong with them. Nonetheless, doing this research in so many ways convinced us of the relevance of that base as a place from which young women, in fact, are continuing to be recruited, and that's absolutely crucial at the current period. What Cheryl pointed out this morning about the pessimism and the optimism involved in thinking about racism and the women's movement is absolutely central to the fact that the National Women's Studies Association this year declared its national program to be on the link between racism and sexism, and that running a conference for feminists, black, white, and any other group on racism is absolutely part of thinking for their possibility of recruitment for future generations, otherwise we lose out in the next generation. When the percentage of organized women workers declined in the 20s, the Women's Trade Union League lost a major area for recruitment. Right now, one of the most obvious hopes for feminism in the 80s is that women in the labor force are increasingly being organized, and there's been a huge push to organize clericals in communities, for example. The unionized female workforce is an obvious for both expanding and transforming what feminism means today. Our point here is not to be workerist and talk about the needs of the trade union movement and women, but it's absolutely in our self-interest to make the coalition where there will be no more recruitment and they've got another those bills. All of these groups that I'm referring to then, whatever their limits, have to be viewed as crucial to our survival when we think about recruiting. Another point, as the movement to restore the family has become increasingly pervasive, some feminist groups have made efforts to become parts of it. The project of trying to make feminism compatible with notions of traditional family life seems a very bad idea to us, because the core of our feminism seems to be a critique of the family as it has been constituted. As in the 20s, the fears of the so-called decline of the family are largely an orchestrated affair rather than a spontaneous popular outpouring. Of course, there are genuine popular fears as a ground for this orchestration, and we need to develop a more coherent feminist vision of what human relations across genders and generations might look like. Our critique of the division of labor, which I guess we would argue is the first time in history that women could have been exactly this critique, that is seeing the division of labor not only in the labor force but in the home as well, not only as material but emotional and psychological as well, that critique raises enormous issues for what the future fate of family life relations might be, and we can't give up that critique. It's absolutely central to what we're doing with it. Millions of women, we should remember, assaulted by that division of labor, both at home and in the workforce, strongly identify with this feminist message, despite the confusion of the time. Final point that we think we get from looking at this earlier period. Lifestyle feminism emerges as an aspect of political defeat and social control then as well as now. Getting yours, assertiveness training, dressing for success are all ways of getting women to look after their individual interests while often demobilizing their political commitments. It is a playing of individualism that takes the form of being anti-patriarchal. Women can succeed at the forces of being generated in the middle of what is really the heart of bourgeois capitalism. So there's class and sex actually. It would be naive to think that we control this discourse, which is being generated at the heart of bourgeois capitalism. But we can combat it where we encounter it. For example, in women's studies programs, in feminist political organizations, and we need to be very conscious of that. Well, we raise these issues because the challenge of the 80s is not only to survive, but to grow, resisting a cultural demobilization by keeping a political analysis in the forefront of feminism.
For this discussion, people should comment, obviously. Say, talk more, not ask.
Right, we talk long enough, you know.
A lot of what you're saying in the conclusions, I think, its application to making feminist issues appealing and relevant to women generally, I think, is much less clear. And that happens to be one of my concerns, because I'm in contact with a lot of lifestyle feminist organizations, and I'm in constant oscillation between simply wanting to leave them and not deal with it, and then recognizing that this is the only point of contact with people. So that in the small town I live in, there was a lot of resistance to my handing out pro-choice literature at a meeting, because the local church, Catholic Church, has a representative on the board of the Women's Center. Okay, so what are you supposed to do at this point? How far can we push people? Okay, that's one thing. The other thing, I saw on another side, again, dealing with mass organizing, is the institutions. Again, not just women's studies programs, but the health centers and the rape crisis centers and the shelters for battered women. We find in a suburban area where people are pretty geographically diffused, that the only way to reach women is through services. That women are not going to come out to meetings, they are not going to come out to hear speakers about reproductive rights, they may come out to hear speakers about job-related issues, advanced self-advancement things. But the fundamental way to get people, to be able to talk to people at all, is by providing meal services that they need, because they haven't got time for this other stuff. They're just struggling to survive. And they don't want to come to another meeting. They don't have time for meeting. They have jobs, children, husbands, struggles of their own, and they can't be reached on a level of spend another 3 hours of your life sitting and listening to someone.
Anybody want to respond to what Jordan's?
I'm just questioning I just want to question one aspect of your presentation, which was really quite mind-boggling in the breadth and extent of depth of it. And that is this: the period of the 20s and 30s, while they do, obviously point out the fact that feminist activities seem to be so, to have declined during that period. The fact is that this was also a period of the growth of leftist political groups where feminists were absorbed. And since feminism always had this dual base of liberal tradition and radical tradition from the very beginning, I think that this is what happened was that people who were radical in their feminism had probably, because of the tremendous tensions in the society after the Russian, and of course feminism in the beginning of the Russian Revolution was a very important issue, and the early Bolsheviks made some very earth-shaking kind of revisions of family law and sexuality, etc. I'm not sure that we really can say that there was therefore that kind of quietude within terms of.
Two very important issues have just been put on the table, and we can discuss either of them, or any of the hands that are being raised aimed at one or the other. Let me just remind you, one was about what happened that was not such a demobilization as a move into activist left organizing.
The demobilization of the feminist part.
Right. Which then never surfaced as specific feminism until much later. And the other being the question of contemporary recruiting of women through the ongoing social services and a time when you feel how do you deal with lifestyle feminism and still
my thought, I have been doing some work in this area.
Can you hear her?
You all
can
hear me?
Maybe people,
it's a big group.
Yes, it'd be good if people could stand. You don't
I have been doing some work on women in the 30s.
tracing some of the feminists in the, or the activists, social feminists in the 30s back to the progressive period, and have found a large women's network existing from the progressive period into the 30s. And central to that were five particular women who stem back to the progressive period. But nevertheless, there was a very strong women's network which had to do with connections with the women's work of the New Deal, had connections with the with Molly Beeson and the Democratic Party. So that I wouldn't, the social feminism certainly, I think that the point that you raised about getting new recruits was kind of lost for me in the 30s, and it might have been largely the war camp alone in the 40s, and that kind of sent everyone, all the women back into work. So that I wonder whether the other thing that I found, and that's a question I want to raise here, was that the attack on women in the 20s by the, you know, the spotting network in the War Department also took place in the 30s. It took place on the UN with the attack on women, on Frances Perkins in particular, and she was one of the leaders of the women's network. And it took place on Molly, against Molly.
Grandmothers directly into us is absolutely crucial, and what I'm hearing here is really very exciting, that there's so much that both can be known and that people are working on to figure out what did and didn't get demobilized and what strategic questions we need to ask ourselves about how women's supports and institutions survive.
I have a comment in response to the first speaker, which does concern me, I think, her point is indicated, and I think you have to understand the importance of the co-optation of service agencies by funding sources who dive into funding codes and cannot use, you know, this funding to do what you can. I mean, it's very much real, it's very much happening in the city today, even though on the state level they're not, you know, against abortion funding. However, if the writers place on the proposal, which, you know, say you cannot use it for abortion funds. So I'm very concerned about that issue. My second point is that on many boards of many service agencies are those kinds of organizations that do not support positions that are pro-choice. And I think we have to just recognize the power of the people that are on the board because they are funding sources, their own, their personal levels of power in the community, and how they can immobilize us in terms of using service organizations as an additional source of support.
At the Reproductive Rights National Network meeting, like 2 weeks ago, there was a really very sophisticated discussion about coalition building, and it was really impressive about what you do about being in coalitions which are very progressive on some social issues, but include a strong anti-abortion component, and how do you stay in the coalition and raise your politics and not allow yourself to be quieted, because when, I forget which city it was, but the meeting was being held in the Catholic Church and the Reproductive Rights Group was told they couldn't come to the El Salvador meeting and bring their literature. And they said quite recently, wait, we're bringing the bodies to this march. You know, we'll find another place to meet. We have to discuss this. You can't tell us to quiet our politics. We want to be in this coalition, but we also want to be able to raise our politics. And that dual level is one of the most complicated things.
It occurs to me, if I could sort of bring in some of the history games, just to tie things up a little bit, in terms of coalitions, wherein a perceived sense of women's issues can be used to break up the coalitions. You've talked about the split between the National Women's Party and the Women's Joint Congressional Committee, and it became vicious. You underplayed it a little bit. I mean, you know how incredibly vicious it got. And, you know, Anita Pollitzer running around delighted because of Atkins Children's Hospital decision, and you know, the personal hostilities were so serious. Yet both groups of people were absolutely certain that they had women's best interests in mind. And so that they were, you know, It was not a case of one being anti-woman. Both were very pro-woman. Yet the perception was allowed to diverge to the point where they wasted most of their energy on each other. And the same kind of thing had happened, wherein everybody was quite certain that they have women's best interests in mind, and in all good faith do.
Yes.
I question whether or not service organizations are an effective way of recruiting women. I don't have that many examples, but I know that in terms of a health center in Massachusetts that I work with, and in terms of my own counseling of young Latin women in East Harlem, the women go to these organizations when they need to secure services. They really don't care about whether the way in which your organization is structured, whether that it's a collective and not hierarchical, and it's participatory or anything like that. I mean, the 15-year-old goes in to get an abortion, and I can remember sitting with a woman and saying, read this thing on contraception. She says, yeah, I know about that. She is never going to contact that organization again, and she's not really interested. And on that level, I question if it's an effective way of recruiting.
You know, I think what we were thinking of not so much is that people come in to use the services would be recruitable, but that the services function, you know, people who work for them, and they their function as nuclei in neighborhoods. I mean, it's a much smaller recruiting pool that you're talking about. Like in the reproductive rights movement, a tremendous base does seem to be in the women's clinics. People who, you know, who work there and volunteer there and stuff like that, and organize out of them, rather than the vast majority of people who, of course, just, you know, just come for the service.
But there's an unfortunate split there.
Yes.
The women who are receiving the services and those who are providing the services, and they never need to get together.
Yeah, I would just like to address the question of appeal of different feminist issues. For instance, the assertiveness training, the dressing for success, has more appeal for women who feel that they have some stake in, for instance, the nuclear family as they know it disintegrating, or people who are afraid of being called murderers by taking a pro-abortion stand in a way that's visible or public. And that's something that I don't know that we've addressed very carefully, in that the alternatives that we presented have been, well, this is right, therefore you've got to overcome these things on your own turf, and then come to us, and then we can join together in these kinds of things, rather than, I don't have very well thought out ideas on how to approach people who are only interested in becoming the, that's their self-interest in feminism. But on the other hand, something that concerned me very much about the talk this morning was people raising issues of problems that we've had and the appeal of various issues as concerns different interest groups. For instance, the questions about lesbian gay splits, the questions that people raised about the one question that one black woman raised to Cheryl Giles about, well, if we were going to prioritize which we thought would be more important, issue of race, issue of sex, which would you respond to, or which would you prioritize? The answers to all of these questions were incredibly glib, and were not very thoughtful, and were very, very simplistic and reductionist. And that, I think, is going to, the price we're going to pay in terms of recruitment on both of those ends is going to be very, very dear, unless we begin to, in a more thoughtful way, address these questions.
Yeah. I'd like to address something that the first speaker said, and I can't hear. Oh, sorry. I said I'd like to address something that the first speaker said, as well as the points that Andrew, sorry. And that is, in terms of how women first came into the feminist movement and looking at what to do about the future, that is, recruiting more women into the movement, I think it would be very important to try and see sort of how that came about. That is, a lot of the first wave, second wave feminism, came through CR groups, came through those personal contacts,
I'm not really sure if we can replicate those for the future, but I do think it's really important to recognize that we're talking bottom line bread and butter issues now. I mean, there's less money going around, less people are getting it, that is the money that is going around. And I think bottom line things are coming to the fore. So it would be important to me in a way to look at how to take from the 60s and the early 70s to the present and the future. Secondly, I'm not really sure, I'm one of those people who is not really all that hot on women's studies as such, because I have a feeling that part of that women's studies is really feminism in disguise, that is, it's moved to the right, and it seems cleaner to say women's studies, because you don't have to politicize it. That's my opinion. At the same time, I also feel that that if we sort of leave go of the past and not recognize how entire vision is going to affect us now, because we talk about specific issues, I really don't think that's going to cut it. I mean, I just don't. But at the same time, to not have a future vision, an entire vision, is going to leave us out in the cold, and we're going to be saying, well, we really aren't talking about feminism, we're talking about women's studies. Or we're really not being political, we're being individual about the situation. That is, I want to become the present case Manhattan, so I'm going to dress for success, I'm going to wear blue suits, you know, things like that. I guess what I'm trying to say is, as we get more and more to the right, I think we're going to see more and more of the individualization occur. And at the same time, we're going to have to face the fact that if we're talking politics, we're going to have to turn that over around. And so I guess I'm really wondering how we're going to do that, considering what the base was in the 60s and the 70s, and since I don't think we can replicate that, how are we going to remain those women?
Arguing and Phil and Bacchus were arguing, it seemed to us that the more and more we looked at what women had to do to defend what they had in earlier times, we share a lot of your feelings about women's studies, and we've both been in and out of a lot of conflict around it, but it became absolutely crucial how central that work is. And I would say that about all the service organizations too. Maybe I'm being naive here, but it is the base that we have at the moment, and to let that disintegrate, given what we know about what happens when there isn't a base, seems extremely dangerous to us, although we absolutely agree. I mean, how you keep it from becoming individualized and fragmented, and in fact, people don't have enough time. It's not just women who aren't already committed. It's plenty of women who are committed don't have enough time in a period of increasing economic cutbacks in their lives. Those are all real problems.
Yeah, I would also argue, for example, at a conference in D.C. on academics, women's academics and activists, that it was fairly clear at that time that there was a very strong source of strength coming from the feminist community, from the activist community, into women's studies,
mm-hmm.
yet the reverse was not
absolutely.
True. And so if we're going to have a situation where women's studies is keeping off of the feminist movement, I mean, excuse the phrase, then the dues have to be paid back, so that when you talk about really being concerned that it's too get senior, I mean, that's important, but if people don't realize where they came from and how they got to where they are, then we're going to be up to treat.
Well, one of the ways women's studies programs can do a little of that is by staying political and feminist, and the pressure to not is so enormous. Because at our school, Ramapo in New Jersey, the funds come from student services. It's another student service, and the students do demand, and I think need also a lot of the they come to assertiveness training programs and so on. And for that to be, for our program to be turned into that service is a constant, strain. And yet the women who want those services, some of them really do get politicized. They actually do get to be feminist and go beyond those services. So, I mean, I find it absolutely totally confusing and, you know, different every day, and so on. But certainly, on one simple level, the women's studies program need to acknowledge their political ties to feminism, and that's hard enough to do as it is.
Do you agree with Zilla Eisenstein's critique this morning that one of the things that make impede a political active feminism is this idea of the denunciation of the straight and lesbian split, you know, in the feminist movement. And do you think that that really is a threat? And do you think that there needs to be some some kind of really strong overall critique by active political feminists on the issue?
I think, could don't you have some answer your...
I'm asking it because I want to, I guess in some way I want to discuss the other topic that's inherent in this workshop, which is compulsive heterosexuality. And I just want to tie that into what I think Eisenstein actually brought up.
One of the places from which we are coming is having done a number of papers together, and then in the reading of Adrienne Rich's Peace in Science, becoming real clear that it's not enough to be general feminism, that to the extent that you don't tie the transformation of compulsive heterosexuality back into every other aspect of the transformation you're looking at, you've got another piece that you're isolating. And well, it works the same way about lesbian baiting as Cheryl was describing about racism, that is, it creates an outsider community who's more available to be stomped on and more available to be stigmatized, and then you can talk about more respectability on the inside of whatever it is you're struggling for. That part seems real clear to us. I would say this time around the women's movement has been less mystified by that because it's got a longer history, and for whatever the reasons, we've been through that split so many times. My own feeling is that we resolve it in practice, and we resolve it by everybody taking the side of lesbians' rights. Now, when that doesn't happen, that's a real breakdown, and that's a real political loss. But it does seem to me that we do have that as a strategy implicit in a very large spectrum of women's movement, including, again, to go back to Zila, parts that look like the mainstream but have been forced to move very, very far on that issue over the course of the last. And that's real important as a kind of a historical strategy.
Yes. Well, I was just going to say that I thought that article was representation. It's been received with such open arms by academia, but it's something that people in the field have been saying for 10 years.
Yes.
And now all of a sudden it's being said, oh, well, what an original idea. As I think academia is the can be the albatross or the anchor, the weight thing that holds you down, in most cases, it's the one that catches up 10 years later, not the other way around.
But what article is this?
It's the article on compulsive heterosexuality by Adrienne Rich that was in the
science.
First Signs issue on sexuality last summer.
Bettina? Yeah, I had 2 points. One was about worrying about whether women's studies programs stay sort of clean. And maybe it'll reassure people who are worried about it that, you know, there are a lot of women's studies programs in this country that are falling apart. And they're falling apart because they're being attacked by the very male institutions often that they sit within that are saying there's no need for women's studies. And people within those programs are very political because they need to be in order just to defend their existence. So there are a lot of programs, and I think you can almost put Barnard Colleges within that particular plot, who aren't doing so well, and they're not sort of coasting while the feminist movement, you know, needs their support. The second thing was in response to your look at the 20s and protective legislation. I don't know whether you wanted to put it as a controversy, whether protective legislation was progressive for women or not. But it is interesting when you read the discussions of the testimony, particularly I was thinking here about the night work laws. And a lot of the desire to regulate women's night work was specifically because men didn't like their women going out to the factories and spending the night there. And there was a particular reference in the Brandeis testimony to the bad language that the women were using and their sort of what you might call today sort of sassiness when they came back. And it sheds a bit of sort of a different light on that kind of protection that was being offered. It was a very, very paternalistic protection.
I mean, I think the minimum wage for women, which flopped, was one that was clearly more less controversially.
Again, it wasn't a minimum income level for women. It was just a minimum wage.
Per hour.
Huh? So it didn't mean that they had enough to live on after those laws. They computed the minimum wage by figuring out what it took a horse to eat in a day.
Well, we'll apply to you further later. elucidation and information. We have a lot to learn about. That is, it would be all right if the RA passed, and I'm sure that was said in the 20s when suffrage came about for women. But it seems to me that all those other issues don't fall at the same time. Am I being sure?
I think basically you're right about now, but that sort of allows me, I think, to get back to something that the woman in the red sweatshirt said about before, that the community and that the women's studies program was perhaps behind the community. And I think that this term that I realize at the moment she's talking about a completely different community than I'm talking about. She's talking about the community of active feminists. I'm at this point much more interested in the community of all these non-political women who have all kinds of needs and are not in a position to put their needs in feminist language. They know they have needs, but they're not going to express them in terms that fit in with feminist theoretical categories. And I think that the question of now kind of ties in with that, because now is, I have some experience with now, and it's basically very frustrating, but now is a hybrid organization. And its national organization is very separate from its local organization. Everything you said about national now, I think, is absolutely true. And I had a terrible time trying to get a local now chapter to do an employment project, and I couldn't even get national now to return my phone calls or answer my letters or anything like that. And we had to give it up. And I think everything you say about that is true. But local now, because of its real great separation from national now, some of it is very active in other ways, and some of it is not, and it varies enormously. I would say in defense of New York State now, that their position on lesbian rights has been very strong over the last couple of years, and they have no intention of giving it up, I know that. And they do work on, they've been very active on various now chapters in New York, mobilized a lot of people to go up to Albany to lobby on the question of retaining Medicaid funding for abortion. So that I think, again, your community varies. Your organizations vary and your communities vary. And I think you have to be way more precise about what we're saying, you know, when we do this.
Well, I just like to add the same thing to the encouragement community. You would have to realize that these women they may not be fully aware of their political implications. You know, they cannot consider themselves to be
individual needs as if that somehow something shameful. And with people talking of appealing more broadly to women who are not, quote, politicized, I think one of the things that happens is that very denigration of doing something in quotes for yourself. So if you're thinking of your job, your family, your sexual needs, your mode of bringing up your children, whatever it is, and not seen as a broadly political movement is often dismissed. One of the things that came up this morning that I thought of is over the 10 or 15 years that I've been involved in the women's movement, hearing people talk about employment in a sense where it only counts if you have, quote, have to work the new economic situation. So that woman who comes from a position of thinking, well, I'm the identified person who plays
at work and I could be supported, is being kicked out. I see that woman as retreating and saying, you're not taking care of my needs. Suddenly there's no place for me because I'm middle class, I'm white, I'm educated. And I don't think that the way to get the women's movement broader is to ridicule and to denigrate the individual need, but to make a coalition of saying, we're working for you if you're working because that's self-actualization, if you're working because you need bread on your table. And that's what says to the lesbian group, to the black mothers group, to the educated white, whatever group it is, this individual need is another need that has to be supported. And there's nothing wrong with union service organizations, with being concerned about whether you're going to need an abortion, that it's going to be limited what kinds of contraception you can use, whether your child or you can get an education. One of the tones that I've heard increasingly that makes me very uncomfortable is that concept of it's only valuable if it's for a general political stance as opposed to an individual need. And truthfully, I think there's a very small body of women that continues in a purely political place, and something that diminishes as you get older. I watched my friends when we were in college who were much more, quote, politicized than we are in our 20s, 30s, and 40s. People do get involved much more in their narrower personal world and want to see feminism addressed to that. And then I think it gets fed back into the feminist movement, as opposed to being attracted as you are in your school years to, quote, the movement. Being an anti-war, you know, that sort of elite chic kind of feeling of being part of the anti-war movement, the women's lib movement, it really truthfully begins to diminish in some ways.
It doesn't happen. You have said so many rich, complex things that we should really take apart. I want to say for myself, we did not intend to demean people's individual needs, but to point out that all such individual needs are socially constructed and hence malleable and hence changing, and we are in a period when there is a concerted effort to change them once again. Part of that means that for a certain group of women who have absolutely legitimate needs, their needs are increasingly going to be defined as narrower and narrower and more individual in a way that will split those that have one possibility to be the worst of the best of the middle class. That is to get what lower middle class and middle class women get in relation to their men of their class. Those women are going to be fed a bill of goods that says individual solutions in relation to what is really a resurgence of certain kinds of attacks against the masses of women. And how you work out the tension between individual need and political community development, that's something since the 18th century feminism has been trying to deal with. It's a big question.
Feminism sometimes acts as if there's something shameful about it, rather than saying, look, this is co-opting you. We also want to address these needs, but this is the other way to fulfill that need, as opposed to, who cares if you have a job? That's not an important thing, or whether your middle class kid gets a fancy education.
I just wanted to extend, I think, some of the things that you were saying. I've done some work on professional, particularly historically, and it seems to me if you contrast the way professional women were doing in the 20s and particularly the 30s with the way they were doing in the late 1920s.
Could you speak a bit louder?
You see some of the dangers of a purely individual approach. I don't think that the speakers want to attack people's aspirations, but for example, women doctors in the 20s did not want to think of themselves as women doctors. They now thought they had gotten to the point where they could just be doctors, be good ones. Whereas the ones in the 19th century saw themselves as women doctors and knew that their community was based on this kind of support for patronage and financial backing. And what happened? What happened was, if you look at the decline of the women's institutions, that outside those institutions, women did very badly in the university setting, as one example. Without the networks, without the kind of women's networks, which I think did go into many different directions in the 20s, the tenure track system was initiated in many places, which meant that women were read out of the system, and particularly the nepotism laws that came in. Now, no individual woman with her aspirations, really, saw this happen, but without that kind of common base, I mean, the separation of professional women from the women's movement was really one of the most devastating things. You didn't allude to that very much. But enough, that's to me what, mm-hmm. what I see as an argument pretty much for women's studies programs today, one of the arguments. That is, without that kind of communal base and ties between women who are interested in their own advancement as well as other things, I think you can witness many of these things happening again. Just to look at each generation of students is kind of de novo coming in. We all assume certain things, but they come in and they're kind of amazed to discover these things that perhaps are obvious to us. And I think if they can get some of that commitment through the course in terms of not just seeing themselves as a doctor, but to try to have that commonality that is very important.
Yes, I just wanted to say that as a psychotherapist, I am looked upon as dealing with people's individual needs. And what really continues to amaze and disappoint me is the complete denial and fear, or at best reluctance, of most of the people that I see my clients to look at any of the difficulties that they have as being, forget socially constructed, at least shared with others. It doesn't matter where it comes from, but there's an insistence on, you know, it was my particular family, and no, you don't understand. Or, and I think that the individual, that might be an individual understanding. And then in terms of individual solutions, I think that they're much, they're satisfying in some way, because then you don't have to face the powerlessness or the wide extent of all the oppressions. Like, if I just get, you know, a little assertiveness training, then I'll be okay. All I'm missing, and it's just me, and I'm missing this little piece, rather than there's something very big happening here. Mm-hmm.
And
that
there.
Yeah.
But I think there's a corresponding piece of that, which is that somebody's going to believe based on their own experience. You're the person that was frightened at that moment, and you're the person that's going to want the assertiveness training. That somehow there's always going to have to be a correlation between what you do and what you experience. I think equally, you know, the whole issue of self-esteem among women is if because we come to a conference like this, we have it, is the other unaddressed piece of today, or how it's influencing our behavior. I don't think that you can look to the out there when it's you that's experiencing it.
I'm not saying that. I'm not even saying looking out there, you know, where it comes from, but just saying, even just like, isn't it interesting that so many women have been through that same fear? And that's why we need assertiveness training. Something really, you know, even more basic and simple.
Apart, yes, on that level.
One more word about individual solutions. As a feminist, I have a lot of problems with that because I think it ignores the relationship between the individual and the larger group, which I think is a very American experience. But because of the way our economy has grown, it has been true that I can get more without decreasing your share. And unfortunately, we haven't had certain experiences that say, have been common in Latin American countries, i.e. Land. There are lots of things for which there is a zero-sum game. For me to get more land, one of you has to give some up. And therefore, your individual solution or your individual goal does affect me. I'm thinking specifically in terms of something along the lines of a Bakke decision. Or in a country where the different disenfranchised groups are pitted against each other, such that your desire to be a doctor is conflicting head-to-head with my desire to attain the same thing. And for us to approach it in an individual manner really leaves us both powerless in the long run.
You want to say something?
Of course, you. There are many feminist problems, obviously, are important in, there are many feminist problems at many different levels. One, of course, a very important problem for the women's movement is obviously how to continuously fight for women's greater participation and more equal participation in politically and economically at a time when you may have a deep de-accelerating or even contracting labor market as over against a period of an expanding labor market. Now, actually, of course, the 30s represented a period of a contracting labor market, and that's why women declined in the professions and everything else, as the men who had the political power began to keep for what few jobs there were for men. But at the same time, of course, the issue of the individual woman cannot be overlooked. If you look even in your presentation of the kind of things that were happening in the 30s with true romances and the movies and everything else, if you see this in a somewhat different light, which you were perceptive about in terms of the boys' clubs, but not really with the women's activity during this point, in that, yes, it is true that, you know, there were fewer ways with the separation of work and home and et cetera, boys had fewer opportunities to understand or learn about male role models and therefore the importance of Boy Scout clubs, et cetera. Well, perhaps true romances in the movies were also important in teaching